Announcement, announcement, announcement. Philosophy versus Improv will be recording an episode live on Wednesday, August 21st, 6 to 7 p.m. in Chicago. The venue is the IO Theater. That's 1501 North Kingsbury Street. This is an absolutely free show. You don't need to buy tickets in advance. Just come to the IO Theater. Be there by 6 p.m. Again, that's Wednesday, August 21st. All of you in Chicago, within drivable distance of Chicago, I will see you there. This is Philosophy versus Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well. I'm Mark Lintonmeyer, Philosophy.
I am Bill Arnett, Improv.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm David Shield, creator of self-deconstructive nonfiction.
Boom. That says it all. Nothing else needed.
You're promoting a book. Name the book.
I've done a new book, and it has a companion film, or actually began as a film and has become a companion book. It's a bit of a mouthful, but I actually like the title and subtitle. How We Got Here, Melville plus Nietzsche divided by the square root of Alan Bloom times Zizek squared equals Bannon. And there's a very cool movie poster where it, you know, it has it as a little math equation.
Okay, okay.
Which I think is very, some people think it's rather pedantic, but I just think it's very cool.
Now you realize I'm not too familiar with Alan Bloom. He can't be negative or zero.
He's a conservative scold, you know, saying that the relativism of the youth today and their left-winginess is ruining society.
Are we taking the square root of a negative number or dividing by zero?
I know. I was showing it to some of my math. I teach at the University of Washington. I'm showing to some of my friends who are math professors and statistician professors and epidemiology professors. And they just said, they helped me sophisticate the math equation, but it makes no real sense, you know, obviously. I just think it looks cool. There's a real argument being made in the book, which I think is, you know, fairly coherent. But anyway, Alan Bloom is a really interesting moment because it's an interesting precursor. About 40 years ago, was it mid-80s? That book of his came out in 87, I believe. It was a huge cause célèbre, but, you know, adopted by the American right, Lynn Cheney, William Bennett. It didn't really work to sort of demonize the perspectivalism, the subjectivity of philosophy and intellectual thought for the last 100 years. And I think it's just, you know, again, you guys are, especially Mark, I think, is more trained seriously in philosophy, much more so than I am. But to me, it's so interesting how the American right demonized that kind of deconstruction in 1980, let's say 84 to 87, all the way up to 92. And now, 2024, it is the weaponized rhetoric of the authoritarian right. You know, I honestly tried to figure out, quote, how we got here. And I think the Alan Bloom was an interesting segue. You guys can, obviously can and will push back against that. But
well, we read it. I read it.
You finished the book too, Bill?
Yeah.
Yes. We do not tend to promise on this show that we're going to read the whole book, but David assured us, go ahead and do it. You'll get through it. And we did. However, the style is interesting. I wanted us to address the content.
What was that wonderful phrase you had, Mark? Blisteringly terse or something like that? I'd love that. I mean, that's going to go on my epitaph. I don't know if you meant it as a compliment or not.
We'll get into it. So I saw in internet searching a bit and looking just, you know, at your list of books at the beginning of this book, that brevity is part of your brand, that you had written a book called Life is Short, Art is Shorter, or rather anthologized. You edited, but you pointed us at an essay to start that this is explicitly, well, what you point out in there as first and foremost is, should books be fat? Or are thin books better? Yes. And I agree that, well, in philosophy in particular, I have a giant shelf of things that I've gotten through about 25% of. And that's just normal for philosophy because unless you're going to spend a whole semester on one of these things, and I have on a couple of them, but even some of the best books in philosophy, my favorite books, I've read 40% of.
I mean, the writers I love, I mean, that wonderful Nietzsche quote, he says, I say in 10 sentences what it takes someone else to say in a book, or rather what someone else doesn't say in a book. I think I actually quoted in that introduction. To me, it's a crucial line. If you can say it in 10 sentences rather than in 10 chapters, that's good. That just shows how concise you are. And second of all, I think there's a point I would argue that the more precise and concise you are, it pushes you into a kind of urgency, an extremity, a kind of Nietzschean vigor. And it's every philosopher I love, whether it's Heraclitus, Schopenhauer, Chiron, Nietzsche, Pascal, they're almost all without exception manufacturers of the aperçu or the aphorism. Like, that's just what I really love, going from ancient philosophers to very contemporary writers. I don't know if it's the attention deficit disorder on my part, but I just love brevity.
Two things that kind of come to mind. One is the quote, probably not really Mark Twain, but the whole, sorry, the letter is so long. If I had more time, it would have been shorter.
Probably not Twain, you don't think? Because it's attributed to him.
Yeah, it's very Twainy.
Everything ever said has been attributed to Twainy. Twain.
But there is the Richard Feynman, the physicist, who said that if you can't explain it to a high schooler, then you don't understand it.
It's easy to write a 10-page letter blathering on, but it's really hard to write this beautiful postcard that just nails it without saying that my work is good or bad. That's for someone else to decide. I just do love that concision.
It's written in very short chapters. It kind of reminded me a little bit of Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, where there'll be a chapter that's just three sentences or four sentences.
It's so funny you mentioned Vonnegut. I was just thinking about him this morning.
And also reminded me quite a bit of the movie I Can't Get You Out of My Head by Adam Curtis.
Oh my God, I love Curtis. I love Curtis with all my heart and soul.
It seemed very similar, which is, again, it's all just news stories or historical video clips that is curated in such a way that it says something. And it can be at times depressing or encouraging or just weird, but I could not get it out of my head.
I do love Curtis. I don't know that particular film. Remind me what that one is.
I Can't Get You Out of My Head, an emotional history of the modern world.
And, you know, every Curtis film is the same movie. I don't know if you know his stuff, Mark.
I can IMDb him, but the name is not ring a bell.
There's an amazing film of his. I always forget the name of it, but it's a three-part BBC series that connects the rise of the American right with the rise of Islam. And it's quite a great movie.
Yeah. It's a collection of short thoughts and quotes and little standalone paragraphs that, as a whole, push the reader in a direction, is what I would say.
You're saying about my book or Curtis or both?
I am. Yeah. And as well as the Adam Curtis movie and, to a limited degree, Cat's Cradle. Yeah.
I remember reading Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five and that introduction to Slaughterhouse-Five, a 28-page first chapter of Vonnegut. It's one of my favorite things anyone has ever written. I was trying to write my first novel 40 years ago, and that introduction of Vonnegut's just totally liberated me. That one could read and write and think this associatively, this tersely, to coin a phrase, this blisteringly tersely.
Can I read an example? Page 42 in the book. To give folks a sense of what the style this is, most of them are often just filled with quotes. So here's one from Arthur Danto, who we've talked about on Partially Examined Life. The future is a kind of mirror which we can show only ourselves. And then a quote from Claude Lévi-Strauss. The first thing we see as we travel around the world is our own filth thrown in the face of mankind. Okay, and then here's David talking. In 1963, Susan Sontag said that ex-Marxists were newly drawn toward Lévi-Strauss, a Marxist, in order to, quote, lay their piety at the altar of the past, since it can't be offered to the future. They have moved not only from optimism to pessimism, but from certainty to systematic doubt. New paragraph. Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorem, 1913. Any system of mathematics is necessarily either incomplete or logically inconsistent. There are mathematical truths that can never be proven. Next paragraph. In 1947, studying for his citizenship exam, Gödel reportedly claimed to have found a loophole in the U.S. Constitution that would allow Americans to elect a dictator. Let me read two more. The Observer Effect, 1920s. The observer, attempting a measurement, alters what he's measuring. Heisenberg's Uncertainty Principle, 1927. Both the position of a particle and its momentum can't be simultaneously and, quote, accurately, unquote, measured. Measuring position more precisely means measuring momentum less precisely and vice versa. And then a parenthetical. Heisenberg himself would get confused between the Observer Effect and his own uncertainty principle. So I present those things, and maybe it's easier to get on a page. You're very much aware of how writing is different than speaking. I started our episode off speaking in monosyllables, and I don't actually think that's the best way to communicate. I would rather, you know, if we're especially having a conversation, but often when I write, I'm musing. I'm thinking around an idea. This is not the digested. The fun is all done for me if it's already digested and I have to boil it down to those three wonderful sentences. Like, okay, I see that idea. It's just I'm not a disciplined enough communicator to want to do that. I want to think around things. So when I'm hitting on something like this, like these are your own dimensions of girdle in the whole thing. Whereas on the partial exam in life, we had a 2-hour discussion of girdle, trying to get at what is the point? Let's actually understand the mathematics. Let's try to explain what the philosophical point is. We're not going to get that out of this. I'm sure a lot of people reading this, probably Bill included, had never heard of Levi-Strauss, right?
I was aware of the name.
Even in the rest of it, there's not a lot actually that would tell you what Levi-Strauss's basic idea was, even in the two sentences. So it almost looks like you're doing something that's more of a haiku for you to ponder. You know, here's a scrapbook of things I've placed together. And it's only going to kind of make sense just in that there's chapter after chapter after chapter that move mostly historically, but often you'll jump backward with a particular quote. And so we sort of get this chain all the way back to Plato to, you know, the fact that people are lying. And I think you've sort of summed up what the premise is that more relativism, more postmodernism, more eschewing objective truth gives an opening for people to talk about alternative facts, etc. Go.
I think there's so much to talk about there that, first of all, you gave a good brief summary of the book. Thanks for that. And thanks to both of you guys for reading it. You know, in terms of my strategy, I think that you chose, you know, a good sample, what, 1, 2, 7, or 8 very short paragraphs. That is kind of the way the book works. But in no way would I say that it's merely a kind of note-taking or haiku. I mean, I certainly love haiku, and some of my favorite philosophers, you know, including, say, Nietzsche or Heraclitus or Chiron or even Schopenhauer time, you know, press toward haiku. But I don't know, it's a very odd style, and the book is very odd. It's not going to appeal to everyone. It's probably baffling to some people. I don't like books that pander to the reader. I just assume that the reader has read some books and is knowledgeable about certain stuff. And I guess maybe, not that I'm some big scholar, I'm not. I'm really just a writer who likes to read and think and write. But to me, the book builds with unmistakable momentum. I'm fond of this idea, collage is not a refuge for the compositionally disabled. Somehow people think, oh, gee, you're just throwing down these quotes on the page. You're not really writing or reading or thinking. And I would just say really heavily, au contraire, like this is very carefully curated, very carefully structured. You know, again, Adam Curtis, whom Bill mentioned, is just a tremendously gifted documentary filmmaker who I've been terribly influenced. This former student of mine once said, she said, I think I get what you're trying to say, what your aesthetic is. Your strategy is just cut out all the boring parts. And that's sort of what I do, is I get rid of all the glue, all the transition, all the explanation, all the sort of discursive logic. In a way, it's a bit like ESPN SportsCenter highlights. Like, I'm just trying to give you the core of the argument. To me, if my books don't work, or if How We Got Here doesn't work for a reader, I think the reader just shrugs and says, you know, I don't know who Levi-Strauss is, I don't know who Derrida is, and they move on. But I think if you hang in on this very brief 110-page book, you can read it in a couple hours, then, you know, an argument clearly builds. I think I do hold the reader's hand enough to explain, here's Socrates saying 2,300 years ago, the only wisdom is knowing how little you know. And so here we are. I'm trying to suggest the philosophical, historical, and intellectual roots of the very confused political moment that we're in. And I think if you read the book through from ancient Greece up to Melville, Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, Sartre, Camus, but the later existentialists, the post-structuralists, then into the right wing's attempt to demonize deconstruction, to me, it gives you or gives me a bit of a sense of how we're in this moment where every single point of information, it's not like it's only an anti-Trump screed. It's not. My books, like Adam Curtis's films or E.M. Chiron's books, they look casual. They look like they're somebody's notebook. But I think if the reader leans in to them, gives them a chance, an unmistakable momentum builds.
You know, you mentioned Steve Bannon and intellectual underpinning and whatnot.
Right.
I think as I was reading it, something that came up to me is like, are we suggesting that Steve Bannon's behaviors and what he's done never would have occurred to him if this intellectual underpinning wasn't there? I think sometimes there are just some crappy people. We've all met them in our lives. And I don't think they're necessarily thinking intellectually or that they need some justification. They just want an expedient justification so they can just keep doing whatever crappy thing they're doing.
Let me try to answer that before David actually gives the right answer.
No, I don't have the right. I have a lot of questions. I don't have answers.
I mean, I think he explicitly says no toward the end of the book. It's not necessarily the case that Bannon wouldn't read these, but that we're in
a milieu,
yeah. Right? So ideas get passed around. And in fact, presenting the ideas in little phrases like this, like that's how politics works. I wish I just saw Harris give her first rally presentation, and it was exactly the same speech that she had given when accepting the endorsement of Biden and getting into it in the first place. If somebody's going to talk to me for 45 minutes or even 20 minutes, I would like to actually have more information than that. But that's not the way things get. We know, of course.
You're not the audience.
Well, the news bite cycle, you know, right. Presenting things in here in terms of little bites. So I would want to intellectually quibble with a lot of them. You know, one of the philosophers we crap on the most is Ayn Rand because she just had sort of a student's understanding of like Kant. Oh, Kant said, everything is subjective. We can't actually know what the world is like. Oh, once you admit everything's subjective, then everything goes, like it's pretty much traces the history that you've given. But that is the dumb soundbite version of Kant. So even though you're giving real quotes from smart people, you know, they're not the most famous quotes in all cases. They're insightful quotes. And they invite me to like, well, what is the context of that? Is this person actually a subjectivist or a relativist? Because most of them aren't. Like almost all the real philosophers, like, yeah, if you're going to throw in surrealists and shit talkers, yes, those people actually might really mean there is no truth. But often, even like when Nietzsche says stuff like that, he's just being provocative. He's trying to twist your mind around by saying something, making you question things you've never questioned before. It's not that he literally believed this corrosive thing, but that's the way that it's been handed down. So that's the milieu that these people are reacting to.
And we will hear David's response to the question after these messages. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You are probably pretty busy. I now have 5 podcasts, plus I teach a class and have a part-time day job. With everything going on, it's easy to let your priorities slip and not engage in proper self-care. You might want to consider as part of your non-negotiable self-care regimen, therapy. Talking things through with a professional can help you cope with everything coming at you, keep you from getting in your own way, get you out of counterproductive cycles. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. Therapy is not just for people who have experienced major trauma. It is a thing that we should be making time for in a civilized society. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. BetterHelp is entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and you'll get matched with a licensed therapist. If you don't like your therapist, you could switch at any time for no additional charge. So never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/improv today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/improv.
I don't know if you're comparing me to Ayn Rand and it's like a student understanding. I mean, I have so much to talk about the questions that both Bill and Mark, you guys are raising, which is in the whole Bannon chapter. I mean, just briefly to quote from it where I say, I mean, I think it's a real question. Did Stephen Miller, did Steve Bannon, did Surkov, who's, you know, I think is a crucial part of this, Putin's kind of puppet master, who is this guy who's a performance artist in France and in Russia. He did read a lot of these deconstructive texts, you know, whether it's Derrida, Saussure, Lacan, all these philosophers of the 20th century who are, you know, pretty subjective, and that in a way he developed this idea of nonlinear warfare. Basically, if you can't dazzle with brilliance, baffle them with bullshit. And that basically you just, as Steve Bannon says, flood the zone with shit. The enemy is the media. It's not the Democrats. You get people so confused, they either disassociate, disconnect, or throw up their hands, or actually embrace it via, say, QAnon. I think Surkov is a crucial transitional figure from Alan Bloom to, say, Trump. But in any case, in that whole chapter on Bannon, I say, so how did we get here? One possibility is that someone smart on the right cribbed notes from the left and turned those notes against the left. Or Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller came up with this stuff on their own. This is what sort of Bill was saying.
an alternative evolutionary species developed on the right. Regarding the early evolution of human beings, do we all evolve together, or did some hominids die out and others survive? Some theorists believe that all the hominids merged into Homo sapiens. Another school of thought argues that if there were dozens of different hominids, several lines survived. Today, we call all of them Homo sapiens. Did one hominid swallow all the others, i.e., did Bannon say, hold the phone, I just figured how to do this? Maybe, though, all these people were just having their own conversations and dropping their own alternative intellectual architecture based on similar strategies in the same way early hominids did. An early hominid snuck over, saw the other tribe, ran back to his own tribe and said, they have these tools. Why don't we try to have similar or better tools? And then I sort of end that riff by saying followers of Marine Le Pen are now reading Foucault, which is actually true. You know, it's kind of amazing. The far right is now studying Foucault. And in this bizarre way, the New York Times has this banner headline they run still, The Truth Matters. Completely baffling to me that the center or center left, however you call that media megaphone, have adopted this neo-Bloomian, neo-Platonic view that the truth, capital T, truth matters. And the right, if you want to call it the right, the authoritarian right, whether it's France, India, China, Russia, the US, has adopted these deconstructive, performative, perspectivalist strategies. And anyway, the book attempts to trace indeed how we got here. That's interesting what you said earlier, Mark, about how you would read 40% or 20% of a book. You're talking about, say, Hegel and reading the first 100 pages or?
Sure, of the phenomenology. Yes, definitely.
And so for me, it's sort of like, do you kind of hate my impulse to love philosophers of aphorism? Like, I don't know what it is in me that loves philosophers, you know, who are very concise, very aphoristic. And I don't know, it's an interesting idea that, you know, whether it's Bill interested in improv, which is a kind of heightened comedy, or Mark's inability to read, you know, the 500 pages, can I please just read the first 100? Or my interest in curated collage and aphorism and brevity, compression. I don't know, I'm terribly interested in this idea of speed and velocity. And then at its worst, am I just falling into a soundbite culture? I think this friend of mine who read the book, who teaches at Fordham, I visited her class and she said, I really don't want to see the collage format here being sold as the ironized version of the soundbite tweet sensibility. Collage demands that the reader set the fragments into fields of possible meaning, of new associations, of questions. It's not just a survey of viewpoints I run through with thumbs up or thumbs down. Anyway, I thought that was an interesting take on the book, which for her is this sort of idea that Trump is the final event in the history of the problematization of truth.
So the selection you read was actually a good rejoinder to the one that I read, because that is a coherent explanation. Like, explanations should be short, because if they're 20 pages long, you've lost the plot. You're getting into too much detail, too many counterexamples. This is analytic philosophy's error, but it's still an explanation and not merely a little phrase or a quotation from somewhere else just sort of put out there for you to think about. It is actually an explanation. I pointed you at, you know, a thing that I wrote on assignment, this philosophy for teens book, where there was very specific, like, and you have to mention three philosophers and you have 100 words to do this. But I still had to try to explain and not just leave stuff, you know, because 11-year-olds who this was aimed at would not like the style in your book, I think, because it does not spoon feed them. So I had to do my best to just, okay, it's going to be just the barest of sound bites, but I'm going to spoon feed them and make them accessible or something. So I feel like there's a pedagogical thing that you're maybe doing something more artistic than pedagogical in this book, which is not bad.
Do you mind if I quote a little more from my friend Nina's take on the book?
Sure.
I just thought, I guess it's very laudatory, but I just think she explains the book better than I have.
You're bringing a virtual friend onto the podcast, and I approve.
There you go. She says, the we in the title isn't NPR subscribers, but all the West.
all of us legatees of the genealogy of skepticism. The book's form insists that the reader narrate this genealogy themselves and engage the complex rhythm of triumphalism, exploitation, certainty, anxiety, doubt, terror, beauty, inspiration, more terror and exploitation and anxiety. Rinse and repeat, so that the reader earns the last fragment, which is the search for truth understood finally as the human tragedy. If you, as the reader, do the work, the genealogy of skepticism and what it entails offers a terrible revelation. 2024 is not an unprecedented insane asylum. I am not the smart and good watching the moronic and the evil take over. I'm not even the sleeping good letting the evil take over. This is the continual agon or conflict or, you know, drama tension of Western skepticism. Once you admit what is truth as a live question, you set in motion the world of how we got here. I hope that doesn't seem like self-applause, like, yay, my former student likes my book. But that's a coherent argument for what the book does. It's a generous reading of it. And that, to me, is the book. And I don't know, Mark, you're much more trained in philosophy in a technical sense than I am. But what do you think of her argument? Is she being too generous of what the book accomplishes? Or,
well, I feel like we should, given that this is philosophy versus improv, we should let the book the book speak for itself. And David, we've got some cutting edge technology on here, and I fed the book through. So the person below me on the screen that I'm looking at actually is the embodiment. We've created an AI out of your book, so your book can speak back to you. I call him Bill just because.
This is really heavy, Mark. You're asking me to do a lot here. Let me just...
The thing is, the book doesn't necessarily remember all of its everything that it's ever said. The book doesn't have to be able to recite, hey, book, what's on your page 5? That's not the kind of improv that the book can do. The book is now an autonomous individual. So, I mean, David, did you have a question for your book as now embodied by this homunculus?
AI Bill. I wonder if there's something about the cover of the book being red. Are you trying to say the book is secretly...
communist? Yes.
Red state, and that you're trying to get...
No, that it's secretly communist.
A bull to gore it.
See, the book is very concise.
Wow. God, AI is a fucking genius over there. Okay, Bill, how about the movie? Did you guys glance at the movie at all?
Movies are derivative art forms.
Yeah.
Well, it's like... David Markson says, he goes, tell me the 300th best book isn't better than the best movie ever made. He's a writer I've been very influenced by. He too is very aphoristic, very collage-like. There's a book of his I recommend terribly.
I'm hungry for lunch.
Really? What's your plan? Where are you guys both, in Madison, WI or no?
Well, Real Bill is in Chicago. AI Bill is everywhere.
Existing everywhere at the same time.
I'm in Madison, yes.
Do you know those guys at Best of Our Knowledge? They seem to like having me on. I'm only doing this show to get on Best of...
I've never met them. I've never gone to the show.
Ah, yes. We see your true motivations.
Do you know them a bit?
I know people that have been to their show.
They've had me on a few times, and I enjoy talking with them about a book I did called War is Beautiful, the New York Times Pictorial Guide to the Glamour of Armed Conflict, which is a critique of New York Times war photography. And it's like the coolest book ever, because the Times sued the publisher. They got so mad about the book.
Talk about me instead. I am your book.
I'm feeding you some book food through the chat here.
Yum, yum, yum.
I thought I was nuts. So anyway, the point being, I'm going to be in Chicago, Bill, for the DNC. I'm going to try to make a little doc film there, August 19th through 22nd. You better be there, Bill. And
bring me to Chicago with...
I thought you were in Chicago.
Tuck me under your arm. I am your book.
We're still in this...
We got our breakthrough. You're still AI?
We're still in the scene, David. We got to make you play this ridiculous game for a little bit.
Did you go to RNC in Wisconsin, Mark?
No. No, heck, no way would I do such a thing.
I heard you were a secret delegate at RNC. And
very secret. Too secret to show up.
Anyway, there's a movie I did called Lynch a History about Marshawn Lynch, and I fed it into AI, and I said, tell me about Lynch a History by David Shields, and they said, it's a movie about David Lynch. I go, like, You're a fucking idiot. It's about Marshawn Lynch.
Clearly. May I question my author?
Question your author.
Perhaps I am wrong, but I would be is expecting more, not more, but some discussion of human motivation and the animal that is the human being to help me understand why people would do these things. Why would they even ask the questions? Are we implying that all humans are thoughtful and reflexive and do think about these things? Why do we do what we do? Why do you do what you do?
Everything is about being bad is more fun than being good. Basically, we are mortal beings. This is what Heidegger gets so right in Being in Time. And it's a great book. It got, of course, allayed to, you know, connected with Nazism and you know, anyway, it's a whole other story. But we are mortal beings. We will die. I will no longer exist at some point. I just turned 68. Mark just turned 38.
I'm 2 or 3.
Bill turned 28. So the point being, we know we're going to die. We are just animals on planet Earth. We will do anything to feel alive for a second, create art, be sex addicts, drug addicts, create political chaos. Everything comes down to me to feeling brief glimpses of eternity shooting through us like lightning. And I think some of Trump's genius, which I think is in free fall, is to get that. People don't take his position seriously. He's just an insult comic. And briefly, he seemed to package that well. Just people want to transgress, to violate their human carapace. I don't know if you guys know Todd McGowan. He's a wonderful writer and philosopher. He had a book called Enjoyment, Right and Left, and how much politics is about enjoyment and how much of the left political rhetoric has become a kind of scolding moralism, and how much the right has sort of embraced briefly amidst Trump a kind of, I don't know what you call it, performative transgressiveness. Todd McGowan quotes terribly helpfully this line of FDR in which he says he got a lot of hatred from the right about so-called packing the Supreme Court in the 1930s and early 40s. And FDR crucially said, "I welcome their hatred." That made it fun to be a progressive Democrat, and that so much of what has to happen, like, for instance, Trump just called Kamala Harris a, quote, radical. She's about as radical as, you know, this pencil. She could not be more centrist or even kind of, she's just a center politician, just like Biden. Like, if she has any chops, if her speechwriter has any chops, she should just revel and just calling Trump is radical. I mean, all that radical means is you're a distance from the center. I think that's right. And that basically Trump is the radical, and she should just say, I welcome their hatred. You know, she should just lean into it instead of saying, oh, no, I'm not radical. I believe in the American Constitution, even though I'm...
Is being responsible ever fun?
Exactly. No, of course not.
So how do we act responsibly while capturing people's imaginations? The scene is over. I'm done being your book. I'm now Bill.
It's a really good point because I was hearing it, even if I was phrasing transgression, performativity, I welcome your hatred. I was thinking like, well, wait a minute, we still have to turn on the lights, like that we still have to pay our bills. We still have to buy toothpaste and we still want a functioning society. And I think, you know, you've captured a good contradiction or gap in my argument, which is, I think you go to Obama here, which is, you know, or somebody said, we campaign through poetry, we legislate through prose. I've sort of mangled the quote. And that basically the election is now. It's got to be all performance, transgression, comedy. You know, the whole embrace of Charlie XCX and Brat, like that's like the first good move they've done in 1,000 years. But then, of course, you govern, I think, carefully, and you govern as prose, you campaign as poetry. That's something Obama got almost to a fault because he was such a pedestrian president, but a gifted campaigner.
So I still want to answer Bill's question as AI Bill, as where human motivation is in here, because the Hegelian strain that I see here, right? You could tell the history of ideas. You can say this idea sort of naturally leads to the next one. You're not talking about specific people, but there's, at least in the last move, like somebody created something, somebody else is going to abuse it. So there's where the human motivation comes in. If anything, I would say, if you're going to look at this book as sort of a dialectic, which of course, Hegel's idea that one idea necessarily historically leads to the next is just a bunch of bullshit. There's so much fluidity. So there's gradual increasing skepticism leads to a self-undermining too self-reflective, self-undermining discourse, which is then weaponized by somebody to say, basically, as soon as you're self-deprecating, you know, this is why politicians can't go and sort of be honest, because then they would have to sort of be self-deprecating and admit, then somebody else is going to jump on that. Well, you yourself said blah, blah, blah. And that's sort of where the line gets crossed, you know, as a comedian or as somebody on a podcast, like, hey, right. It's okay for me to say, I don't have the attention span for that. But once you as a listener jump on and say, dude, you don't even have the attention span to do what you're talking about, then, well, that's not fair. That's not... The one thing I wasn't sure in your book is, like, a lot of people, like Alan Bloom, raised this idea of, oh, these people have degraded truth. So I, from a conservative perspective, and you point out that it's actually the liberals who take this now, you're ignoring universal truth, about goodness, about honesty, blah, 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 in favor of this relativist, take all the power for yourself. Alan Bloom thinks that deconstruction is bad, but it seems like you're saying, oh no, these, you know, retro modernists that are saying absolute truth, absolute goodness, they're just ignoring intellectual history. Whereas you're saying, actually, we should take Derrida seriously, or at least some form of that, maybe up to the existentialists. I stop at Derrida, but through Levi-Strauss is fine.
I think it's a great question. And I guess try and stall for time so I don't have to answer, but like, it's not like I'm politically afraid or artistically afraid. Like, it's a little surprising to me how much I quote Liz Cheney in the book, you know, Liz Cheney's mother, who during the 1980s and early 90s was a fierce proponent of demonizing deconstruction. It's going to ruin the U.S. Constitution, our democracy. It's going to undermine the Bible and blah, blah, blah. And at the time, I thought she was awfully foolish. And In many ways, I still have a lot of problems with her position, both philosophically and politically. But in the context of the book, her quotes are relatively coherent and relatively useful.
You know, I'm pretty much a post-structuralist. I'm pretty much a deconstructionist. I'm pretty much a perspectivalist. I think the truth is very, very hard to know. It's very ephemeral. I think we're trapped in our own subjectivity to a staggering degree. I mean, all those things I believe in as a writer, a quasi-thinker, a filmmaker. And I guess part of me is asking, you know, I mean, again, this book I wrote in 2010 called Reality Hunger, A Manifesto, which tried to bring these issues. So it'd be absurd to claim that my book had some big influence on the Trump campaign, but books like mine,
blurring of genres, undermining notions of truth. It's an interesting thing. I forget what that term is. It's something like what might make sense in one speech realm or one venue, such as questioning the nature of truth, like say Mary McCarthy's book, Memories of a Catholic Girlhood, in which she has a chapter. And at the end of that chapter, she says, well, that chapter was all false. I basically just made it up. And it's sort of a canonical book in the history of autobiography, questioning the nature of memory and truth. You think, oh, that's terribly interesting in the realm of art and philosophy and epistemology. But okay, what happens when that gets kidnapped and placed into the realm of political strategy and political theater and sort of political stagecraft?
That's preposterous, the idea that the Times is printing truth. That's absurd. I mean, just look at this book of mine, War is Beautiful, the New York Times pictorial guide to the glamour of armed conflict. They were carrying water for Cheney and Bush for, you know, 10 years. They got that word so wrong.
It's a beautiful thing you've said there. And that's actually why I've hired you and Mark to be my political strategists. And I'm excited to be working with you and can't wait to get my campaign up and running. So you're telling me there is no truth. Do I get out and say that in front of people? There's no truth?
I mean, that's where it gets really complicated.
Reminded me of
some of those Republican pollster types.
I remind you of a Republican pollster? That's a bad thing. I don't want to be.
You had like a Michael Murphy or a kind of Rovian element to you there. You suddenly had an aggression that was freaking me out there, Bill.
What do you say, Mark? What do we do for my political campaign?
You can tell them that there is no truth as long as you spit it at them. You can't just say, ladies and gentlemen, there is no truth. But when somebody starts to say something that you don't like, you can say, there's no truth, and add fuck you, just to really nail it home.
Okay. There is truth, and that truth is what you said is stupid. Gotcha. All right, that'll work.
I'm thinking of a good moment where Obama was running for his first campaign, and he was... Mm-hmm. Do you remember that fellow in Chicago? He's probably your best friend, Bill, that guy who was Obama's minister at the a church in Chicago. I forget his name, but you know, he was a
Jerry. You should not emphasize that association, Candidate Bell.
Okay.
You know, there's this idea that Obama was being charged with guilt by association because maybe some of this preacher's rhetoric was being phrased by right-wing media as being sort of racially inflammatory or whatever, because he was pointing out racial oppression in this country. So Obama's press secretary went on Fox News, and rather than saying in some boring way, like, you are targeting Barack Obama with guilt by association, so what if Obama attended for a few times the session of this guy's sermons and Obama is not racially inflammatory, blah, blah, blah. Instead of doing that, the rather boring discursive thing, this press secretary went on Fox and started tarring everybody on the show with their own guilt by association. He was embodying the strategy rather than discussing the strategy. So let's say it was brilliant rhetorical and political theater. They said, hey, you're targeting us with guilt by association. He goes, exactly. That's exactly what you've been doing to Obama and his minister. I'll have to get that story polished up a bit. But it was brilliant political rhetoric. And in a way, that's what I'm arguing for as political strategy, doing the thing rather than talking about.
Gotcha. All right. Short answer. Here we go. Short answer time. Would it be unsettling for people to know there is no truth?
Yes, but it's good. Then they will be knocked back and they will obey.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating question because, you know, it's the third rail of American politics.
Short answer, David. Short answer. Is it healthy to my campaign to tell people that there is no truth? Or do people want to know that there's a truth and then I will lead them to the promised land? And the truth is, I'm the best man for the job.
Definitely the latter. If I were your political.
Okay. All right. Now we're getting somewhere. If there is no truth, why can't people accept that? Mark, short answer, go.
Because then they would have no way to defend their existence.
Okay.
My God, that was just straight out of page 87 of my book. Mark nailed it.
Okay. Okay. All right. If there truly is no truth, but people want there to be truth, that's where we step in, right? That's where our campaign fills that gap, huh? Is that what you're telling me?
You want to just redefine truth to be something subjective and individual, because then you can defend yourself. It's only when you say there is no truth as an objective standard that we all must contemplate the same data and come to the same conclusions. That's a non-starter. We're not going to do that. So you say, yes, this is my truth. I'm speaking my truth. That sounds very personal. People think you're a personable person. They might even think you're a person if you're so personable.
I'm a power and money conglomerating machine.
So I don't know, AI, if you've heard of Slavoj Žižek, but he says when the ancients said, I love you, they understood I love you to be built in with all of these qualifications that we now have. It's a necessary fiction. When you say, I love you, you're probably thinking internally, well, I don't know. Does she love me? Do I really love her? He says that we're terribly naive, we postmoderns, thinking if we say, I love you, we're somehow committing to some ideal. He says the idea when you say, I love you, or there is a God, or America's a democracy, or I feel your pain, that people understand those to be fictions, and that those are what you might call a necessary angel of political.
Turn a phrase.
I mean, I think they're not fictions, they're performatives. You're not saying, hey, if you were to analyze my brain and look for the love neuron, you would see it's firing like crazy. You know, you're making a commitment. You're saying, I love you. And you know that you're committing yourself to something that is actually eternal and beyond, you know, what human beings are capable of.
How would you make a distinction, Mark, between performative and fiction? A fiction would be knowingly lying. Performative is leaning into the kind of epiphanic moment, something like that.
A performative is you're performing an action that when you say, I do in a wedding ceremony, you are not describing yourself. You are committing an act. It's like a hug. When I say, I love you, I'm basically giving you a hug. And any literal meaning you want to take beyond that is sort of up for debate. It depends what the culture. So when you say, David, that they built in all the qualifications, it sounds like actually, well, when I say I love you, of course you understand that if I found out you were actually a murderer, then I don't really love you. or if I don't understand myself, there are limits in my own self-knowledge. So to the extent that I understand, you know, so really you should get a lawyer if you want to give an accurate description.
Okay, that's a long answer. How about this? I'll only say that I love the things that don't have a solid definition. I absolutely love America. I absolutely love freedom.
I mean, what?
Good luck defining those things.
Okay, sure. If you want to argue, part of postmodernism is that there are no necessary and sufficient conditions. You've sort of left Wittgenstein out of the history here, David, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of family resemblances.
Doesn't he show up a little bit? It's a good point. I hope he shows up. I love him with all my heart and soul.
Do you? I thought can we love?
At one Bertrand Russell line, he's waiting for Wittgenstein to show up on the train. He goes, God just arrived on the 938. I've always loved that line mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. neither Russell believed in God, but here comes Wittgenstein.
I prefer my campaign to use airplanes. Is that okay? We can fly places rather than use the train.
Does a helicopter count as a plane? It seems like maybe we should.
No helicopters. Okay. Too dangerous. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to Kobe myself.
All right. So only something really big like a blimp.
What a Kobe is now a verb. Whoa.
All right. So not only are we running out of time, but your microphone keeps.
That was all intentional. I was trying to show you how difficult the speech act is. I was turning the mic on.
I mean,
and
it's good to just be able to contemplate the last half of someone's sentence to really, it implies its beginning. It's like Infinite Jest, where he just got to a point in it and said, you know, I'm going to stop because you could figure out the rest. Except you're doing it in reverse, so you're even more sophisticated.
Wow.
The corn. So anyway, yeah, that is one overrated book. It's been great talking with you guys. And when it goes viral, I'll be sending you guys checks. Right. So thank you.
We will hold you to that. That was not a lie. That was the truth.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, David.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bankrupt. Bankrupt. Bankrupt.